Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest example of the US military's inability to deal with the epidemic of sexual assaults in the ranks following the plea deal to drop charges for sexually assaulting a female subordinate officer, which allowed an Army general to plead to lesser charges of maltreating an Army captain in an unwarranted manner. Jennifer Norris, a former U.S. Air Force tech sergeant who was forced into early retirement because of post-traumatic stress disorder from military sexual trauma, joins us to assess the chances of bills by Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and Congresswoman Jackie Speier moving forward to fix the broken system of military justice. Then we'll examine a nightmare scenario that exposes our post-Citizens United campaign finance system's invitation to political corruption and abuse of non-profit social welfare groups to hide the identities of those buying corrupt politicians. An investigative reporter who has covered the story from the beginning, Robert Gerke, a politics and government reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, joins us to discuss his and the Utah House's investigation into the former Attorney General of Utah, who transformed his office into a defender of payday loan companies who secretly funded his election campaign. Then finally, we will speak with Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect and author of Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity Versus Possibility. He joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, The Democrats' Obama Problem, and what the president can do to inspire Democratic voters to come out in November to prevent a Republican takeover of the Senate, which will render Obama an early lame duck, effectively paralyzing the last years of his presidency. And joining us now is Jennifer Norris, who's a former U.S. Air Force tech sergeant who was forced into early retirement because of post-traumatic stress disorder from military sexual trauma. She currently volunteers at the Military Rape Crisis Center, helping both active duty and veteran victims of sexual violence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Norris.
Thank you for having me.
And Jennifer, this Army General Jeffrey Sinclair pleading guilty to lesser charges has, I think, upset a lot of people and once again brought attention to this broken system of military justice that is controlled by the chain of command. And in this case, the military judge last week suggested that by holding out for more severe punishment and by rejecting an earlier plea deal, the chief Army officer overseeing the prosecution might have been improperly influenced by political considerations in bringing the most severe charges against General Sinclair. That's a very strange piece of logic, isn't it? I mean, he's saying that the prosecutor is charging this guy because of external politics and the sense that something needs to be done about this issue. I mean, what do you make of it?
It goes back to the chain of command argument that we've been having from the get-go, which is, you know, the troops are concerned that the commanders have bias against them as far as pushing forward with a case. And if you want to flip the coin, of course, now a defendant is feeling like the commander's being biased in the other way. And this is the very heart of the argument and why we want to pull it out of the chain of command and put it into the hands of professionals and those that, you know, have places to store DNA and other critical evidence in order to prosecute in the end. It's the very heart of the entire argument.
So this doesn't surprise you then, this judge's ruling last week in allowing Brigadier General Jeffrey Sinclair to avoid prosecution on sexual assault charges and plead to mistreating a junior officer?
No, it doesn't surprise me at all because it's pretty much what happens with every case that I've ever seen or assisted with. Less than 10% are prosecuted and found guilty in the end. And only 13% in 2012 actually reported. So this case just highlights once again why the troops don't report if the general's allowed to get away with it, then pretty much everybody's allowed to get away with it. And if they aren't going to show the troops that they're going to take things seriously and hold generals accountable to, then how can they take everybody else seriously as well? And whether they mean well or not, it's these positions that leaders are taking that are actually stunting people even more from coming forward.
Well, in this case, to use the very idea that there's a concern out there in the public, and the military judge is saying, well, the prosecution is only trying to show new resolve against sexual misconduct, and then he turns around to make a mockery of it. So that's the part of it that I find extraordinary. In other words, somebody gets off for a sexual assault because sexual assault is a problem in the military, and that he may be being scapegoated for the problem as opposed to being punished for the problem, of which he's pretty clearly guilty, right? Although apparently the prosecution was shaken by revelations that the general's accuser may have lied under oath. What do you make of that part of the decision?
Well, I think that it goes right back to the chain of command argument again, and the concern about undue influence. And I don't know if you remember when there was some backlash on General Amos from the U.S. Marine Corps because he came out with a tough stance on sexual assault. Well, he got slapped down by the defense attorneys for doing just that because it was considered undue influence. And this is exactly, we're going right back to the heart of the problem again, why we want to pull those commanders out of there so we don't have to worry about undue influence and we could just focus on justice, getting justice for the victim and also holding the person who harms another accountable for what they've done.
Again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Norris, who's a former U.S. Air Force tech sergeant who was forced into early retirement because of post-traumatic stress disorder from military sexual trauma. She currently volunteers at the Military Rape Crisis Center, helping both active duty and veteran victims of sexual violence. But the problem here is that, again, this epidemic is not getting the focus and not getting the headlines it deserves. And the statistics are appalling. I mean, it just gets worse and worse and worse. And the figures that are being presented are only a fraction of what really happens because so many victims of sexual assault in the military don't report them. So the problem itself is already underreported, is it not?
Absolutely. It is definitely underreported. What the public is hearing is only the numbers of sexual assaults and rapes. So the 26,000 that they're throwing around is actually only sexual assault and rape. It's not including all the precursor crimes that would be, you know, maybe the sexual harassment, or maybe, you know, the bullying or the hazing or any of the kinds of things, or the stalking, those kinds of things that kind of build up to the ultimate crime. If we could pay more attention and make those crimes more severe, we could prevent these other crimes from happening. But we're still in crisis mode, focusing just on how we're going to process when someone's actually touched.
So what then happened? I mean, we thought there for a while, just in early March, there was a Senate bill put forth, championed by Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democrat of New York, that would have removed commander's authority from making prosecutorial decisions and then giving that to impartial military prosecutors. So in other words, taking the prosecution out of the hands of the chain of command, because we know a similar thing to this ruling that just took place on General Sinclair happened at the Aviano military base in Italy, where the commanding officer, because he knew the guy on trial, the pilot on trial, basically just on his own volition threw the charges out. So It seems, though, in terms of what Senator Gillibrand was trying to do, that seems reasonable. But the amazing thing was that she didn't get – she only got 55 votes. She didn't get to the 60-vote threshold that's required to overcome a filibuster. From other Democrats, Claire McCaskill of Missouri, and also on the Republican side, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, not to mention, of course, the former presidential candidate, John McCain. So how do you explain the resistance going on the Democratic side to Senator Gillibrand's bill?
I think what it is looking at a big picture. Senator Gillibrand was trying to really attack at that 87% of troops who don't report. So what she was trying to do was well-intentioned, and it may have helped make the reporting go up, which would ultimately help us with getting the prosecutions to go up. But what we really needed was a different place for them to report, yes, other than their boss. But also, we did need the things that Claire McCaskill had suggested in her bill, the biggest things being getting rid of the good soldier defense, and also if the crime occurs off base, then the military member will have the chance or the opportunity to report it to the civilian without, hopefully, the military coming in and trying to take jurisdiction, which is what quite frequently happens. So really what we needed was a combination of all the bills, including Representative Spears, to make it the most comprehensive. But I applaud Senator Gillibrand for going after the root of the problem, which is the lack of reporting.
But what explains why Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman Carl Levin, who's considered a liberal, why does he argue in favor of the status quo against Gillibrand's bill?
I think that everybody falls victim to the same kind of mentality, which is the DOD quite often comes across like they know what they're talking about, that they're taking care of business, that, you know, they're trying to fix this, that they really do care. And I think that we are moving in that direction. I just don't think they realize, the leadership themselves realize, the extent of the problem that they've got in front of them as far as what it's going to take for legal expertise to clean up this mess because it's been let go for so long. And I think once we do open up this, to tell you the truth, I think that the reason that they're not supporting Gillibrand is they don't want to impact recruiting numbers. And when the truth comes out about how bad this really is, it will, in fact, impact recruiting numbers in the military.
So just to give our audience a sense of the problem, Jennifer, can you just describe what happened to you and why this is such a problem? Because, you know, you end up being victimized more than once. The sexual assault itself is should be enough, but then that gets compounded by the fact that you essentially are you know, the victim is the system turns on the victim in effect. Is that what happened to you?
That's exactly what happened to me, unfortunately. The predators know that it's a he said, she said case within the military or, you know, whoever their victim is. And so they prey on those opportunities where they have the power to do what they've got to do, but also where they have the opportunity to do what they want to do. And then they know, bottom line, that it's going to get reported to their commander or whoever it is who they might be close to, and then they can just dampen it down and make it look like you just didn't, you know, respond well to their advance, when in fact it literally was a violation of human rights as to what they did. And the soldiers trying to remain strong by, you know, coming forward, letting someone know that this is what happened and that it's not okay.
So in your case, you had to leave the military because there was no justice for you, and the trauma of what happened to you was compounded by what by the lack of justice. And I take it that you had to leave the military because of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes, that's exactly what happened, and which is the reason why I'm so involved in these efforts, is I'd like to ultimately prevent the PTSD from getting to the debilitating state that I have it and other veterans have it, and have some healthy troops here, because all they need to do is report a crime and be supported through the process, and then they can move on with their career. But unfortunately, for some reason, nobody wants to deal with it, and it's too much work. And the next thing you know, people are resentful. People, you know, are thinking you might have made it up because they're friends with the perpetrator. There's all these inner dynamics that occur that beat your mind down. And after you've already been basically taken advantage of by someone, any other trauma that comes your way is just pushing the original trauma down, because they don't feel safe. And that's why the trust and the betrayal in the military is what's hurting us the most and leading to the suicide. They feel they have no way out if the person above them isn't going to support them. And that one person can't do it alone. We need a system in place to support them.
Well, one of the things I've found out in looking into this issue of sexual assault in the military is that while you know the figure out there is the last year there was 26,000 cases, and as we've mentioned, that is way lower than only 10% or something of the real figure. But one of the things I found extraordinary was that whereas most of the cases are of male officers sexually assaulting subordinate female officers or enlisted people, there's also a lot of men are assaulted by other men in the military. And that's a big part of this that's not ever publicized.
That's right. And it goes to show how bad the predator problem really is. Predators don't discriminate. That's why we're pushing to have it pushed to the civilians, because all these predators, and I'm talking in garrison right now, we haven't even talked about how we're going to deal with it in a war environment. But at least here in the States and in places where the military bases are embedded within our state, we can work on this together and funnel all the people that are accused through one entity, one civilian entity, as opposed to dealing with a commander that might be transferring soon. The predator might be transferring soon. So that now what? There's all kinds of transient issues that come with trying to get justice in the military, whereas in the civilian sector, it is what it is. They've been doing this for a long time. You know, they're going to take down the statement. They may even arrest the person. They handle it the way it's supposed to be handled, as opposed to the way it feels like the military handles it, which is, I don't want to deal with this. Let's just make this go away. And that's been, the victims being retaliated against when their career is over.
Well, just in closing, what do you think then of the bill by Congresswoman Jackie Speier, who, of course, was one of the people who founded the group Protect Our Defenders, which has mobilized more than 400 soldiers and veterans to tell Congress of their experience of being victimized by sexual crimes?
It is the bill. It's the closest thing we have to the real answer. It's been there all along. And it got stifled by, all these other things that happened along the way. And I want to bring it back because it gets to the crux of the real issue, which is, yes, do we have a reporting issue? Yes, we do. But we also have leadership issues, accountability issues, retaliation issues. So, you've got your officers in charge of your enlisted to take care of their punishment, but who's going to punish the officer? And when we do see them punished, quote unquote, it's basically, oh, bad boy, you're going to have to retire now. Or, oh, okay, well, we'll just do a plea bargain and you can retire too.
Well, Jennifer Norris, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Norris, who's a former U.S. Air Force tech sergeant who was forced into early retirement because of post-traumatic stress disorder from military sexual trauma. She currently volunteers at the Military Rape Crisis Center, helping both active duty and veteran victims of sexual violence. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about this textbook case of political corruption in terms of campaign financing coming out of Utah.
Took my pearl and left an empty shell of me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Gerke, who's a politics and government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. He has been covering the case of the former Attorney General of Utah, John Swallow, who resigned in last November after less than a year in office amid growing scrutiny of political corruption. Tuesday's New York Times has a front-page story talking about this, the State House investigation of this former Attorney General. But you were on it from the beginning, and I guess it is getting a lot of publicity because it's kind of a textbook case where a candidate colludes with wealthy corporate backers and promises to defend their interests, and then these companies spend heavily on this candidate, but of course they hide the money by funneling it through nonprofits. So let's go back to the beginning. When did you first get wind of this story?
Well, I mean, we've been reporting on this. I guess our first story broke in January, just after he'd been in office for about a week. And that story was more focused on arrangements he had made with, you know, wealthy donors, wealthy backers, businessmen who had supported previous campaigns that he'd been involved in. This issue with sort of the dark money, as it's called, with the 501 being funneled or laundered through the 501c4s, was something that really kind of came to light largely because of the investigation that the House Committee had done. They had the ability to get at some records that we were unable to get at, and so you know, what they found was obviously that there were hundreds of thousands of dollars, most of it from the payday lending industry, that had been channeled to the Attorney General's campaign through these 501s, used for, you know, attack ads on his opponents and so forth, and done so that it wouldn't come back to show the linkage between the payday lending industry and the candidate, because they felt that might be damaging to his, you know, politically damaging, as he was running the campaign, to be seen as the candidate of the payday lending industry.
So, but this fellow Swallow had already worked as a lobbyist for one of the biggest payday loan companies, Check City, in Provo,
right,
Utah, whose founder apparently he was sort of thought walked on water.
Yeah, they had a very close relationship. You know, Richard Rawl had given $100,000 through these 501s to Swallow's political effort. You know, and he had spent close to 5 years, I think, working as a lobbyist, a government relations advisor to Richard Rawl in Check City. So the tie was there before. It wasn't something that was unknown, but then he had left the payday lending industry in 2009 to go work for the Attorney General's office, and then in 2012 was when he was actually running for Attorney General himself.
And this money that came, I mean, first of all, didn't he give advice to the payday loan industry saying, you guys have got a bad reputation, which is, of course, justifiable since they that charge more interest than the mafia would ever dream of, sometimes up to 400%, and prey upon poor people. And they've been banned from being near military bases by General Petraeus's wife. Holly Petraeus led the charge to get Congress to stop these predators from going after service people. Not that they have stopped doing it. So it has, I think, a justifiably ugly reputation. So the candidate then tells these people that you got such a bad name, so we're going to have to hide the money through these vehicles that have become the favorite, instrument du jour of campaigns. You know, Karl Rove and others have been creating 501c4s, overnight and often, shall we say,
So, yeah, I mean, these are becoming a fairly common tool of the political consultants and the political campaigns to, we saw them in the most recent presidential election used pretty broadly, frankly, to allow unlimited amounts of money from undisclosed individuals to be used for, who knows what in terms of supporting candidates. And this is just one of the instances that have arisen recently where this has come back to, or maybe there's been some light cast on the use of these tactics.
But specifically to get the money, and first of all, didn't the candidate and his political advisor, they also took fees from this money, didn't they, for themselves?
The political advisor did. It's a little less clear, I think, whether the candidate did himself.
Right.
And there was an attorney who was helping the consultant set these up, and this attorney has been, setting these up in other states as well. Pennsylvania is one prominent example where he set these up. And one of the things that was kind of interesting about it is there is in some of the court records that have accompanied this investigation, a confidential informant said who had worked on the campaign told investigators that they had witnessed these two, the attorney and the consultant, fabricating the books, cooking the books when they submitted it to the IRS, because under the IRS rules, you can only put a limited percentage of the money you raise toward political causes. Some of it has to go toward social welfare and whatnot. So the confidential informant had said they witnessed him cooking the books. The IRS later came back to these guys and said, we'd like you to provide us with additional information about your filing. In the latest report, one of the really interesting pieces of it was they felt like they didn't have to provide the IRS with that information because there was this flap involving the IRS cracking down on conservative groups. And they felt that because of the turmoil that the IRS was in, that they could disregard the request from the IRS to provide them the additional information, which is sort of an interesting fallout from that sort of national scandal about the IRS targeting these Tea Party organizations.
Which, of course, was itself, like the Benghazi story. It was somewhat trumped up, and only a small part of the picture was presented, because they went after, I think, more liberal groups than they did conservative groups. Again, I'm speaking with Robert Gerke, who's a politics and government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, and he's been following the case of the former Attorney General of Utah, John Swallow, who's become a textbook for how to create 501c4 organizations, which are tax-exempt vehicles supposedly meant for social welfare that are being used now to hide the donors. In this case, he went to the donors and he'd previously worked for and said, I'll become your champion of payday lenders, but you can't put your name on this because you're unpopular, so we'll create these fronts. And then the money that he used was used for attack ads to hurt this fellow called Brad Dorr, a four-term Utah state representative who was a Republican and who'd been pushing for legislation that would have, reined in these payday companies from making loans to individuals already deeply in debt. So there's a win-win for them there, right?
Right. The money, yeah, that's true. That's a good point, because the money wasn't all used for John Swallow's political campaign. Some of it did go to run attack ads against John Swallow's opponent. But, yeah, a good portion of it did go to run attack ads and mailers and hit pieces against this state representative who had proposed. What he had proposed was creating a database where if you go in to get a new payday loan, it puts your name through the database to see if you have other outstanding payday loans, just to keep people from getting in, you know, so deep over their head that they couldn't get out. Of course, the industry opposed this. They fought it. They ended up defeating Brad Dodd, who was, you know, a fairly popular incumbent in a conservative district, and they beat him with another Republican who, you know, so yeah, that's where part of the money went. And again, you know, it was channeled through the 501 to organizations that were, you know, the money wasn't reported, the sources of the money wasn't reported. In fact, while these attack ads were going on against Representative Dahl, we asked the person who was running the ads whether they were tied in any way to the payday lending industry, and he said that they weren't.
So that's the beauty, if you will, of these vehicles, right? They hide the donors, they hide the amounts, and they always come up with some mom and apple pie label, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, this was the proper role of Government Education Association. it was putting money into a group now that is called the Hope Change Organization, which I think is probably a play, you know, on the Obama slogans from his presidential campaigns. But, you know, so, yeah, they come up with these very either generic or patriotic kinds of names. And even when you find out where the money was coming from or where it was going, you know, in this instance, for example, it's well after the damage has been done or the outcome has been decided.
So tell me, Robert Gerke, again, a politics and government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. There are some indications that at least two of the prosecutors involved in this long-running investigation of Swallow, one's a Republican and one's a Democrat, have apparently said, this is according to one of your articles that I'm looking at now, that their inquiry turned up allegations of misconduct by the Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, a Democrat of Nevada. So tell me, what is there a smoking gun there?
Well, this in January when we reported on this initially, and we're talking January of 2013, so over a year ago, there was an allegation that was made that the online poker playing industry had made essentially a bribe to Senator Reid to support legalizing online poker in the United States, and made a cash payment of over $1 million to an organization that was affiliated with him. You know, that is something that presumably would be under the federal purview, but these, you know, the county attorneys certainly don't have the resources to look at anything like that. So there were allegations arising from Senator, you know, relating to Senator Reid early on. These county attorneys recently have said, you know, there are other issues that related to Mike Lee, and they just don't have the resources or the legal reach, I guess, jurisdictional reach to investigate and prosecute these as they might need to be done. Now, the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Department of Justice did investigate some of the matters arising out of the Swallow case early on. I mean, they were actually investigating this potentially all the way back into early 2012. In September of 2012, the Public Integrity Section said it specifically, as it pertained to the Attorney General at the time, that they weren't going to be filing any charges against him. So it's kind of hard to tell, because these federal investigations do kind of take place behind the curtain, so to speak, you know, and so they may be looking at it, maybe they've looked at these, you know, but these county attorneys have said they did acknowledge that there have been some allegations or alleged impropriety that pertained to those two senators. So it could have a wider reach than what we've seen so far.
And of course, Senator Mike Lee is an extraordinary case where he's the Tea Party favorite, and he became senator through a caucus, not even an election, knocking off an incumbent who was very conservative. That always struck me as being pretty extraordinary. And he apparently has raised, or he, this attorney general, this fellow that's, that we're talking about, Swallow, he apparently raised money for Lee's successful 2010 campaign, rounding up donations from a St. George businessman, Jeremy Johnson, whose company, iWorks, prosecutors alleged scammed customers out of $275 million. Well, tell me what's behind that.
Well, that was sort of what spawned the original stories, again, back in January, was that Jeremy Johnson believed he was under investigation, and he went to Swallow to seek some assistance with this. All of these meetings occurred back in the 2012 timeframe, and Swallow put him in touch with Richard Rawl, who we talked about, the payday lending contact. Johnson paid some money to Richard Rawl, who hired lobbyists who were close to Harry Reid to try to get the investigation into Jeremy Johnson's supposedly fraudulent business quashed. They didn't work. They filed the charges anyway. They filed the civil case against him and froze his assets, and then later criminal charges came. And so Jeremy wanted some of his money back, and so that was sort of the origins of this. Now, in 2010, when Mike Lee was running for U.S. Senate, John Swallow went to Jeremy Johnson and or went to Mike Lee and said, "I can help you. I can help you raise some money." And one of the people he went to raise some of this money from was Jeremy Johnson, who went out to some of his business associates and ended up raising somewhere, you know, it was well over $10,000. And then, you know, Mike Lee also employed this Jason Powers, who was the consultant that set up these 501s for John Swallow as well. He worked on his campaign. So there, you know, it is sort of it all kind of ties back in together and to some degree. And I think there will be, you know, the House investigative report shed some light on some of the relationships between particularly pertaining to John Swallow and these consultants and Jeremy Johnson. And I think there will probably be more coming to light as this sort of unfolds.
Well, because the final irony is that this Jeremy Johnson, whose iWorks business apparently scammed customers out of $275 million, the checks that he arranged for Senator Mike Lee, four of them bounced.
Yeah, these were checks that were written by associates of Jeremy's that he kind of helped round up, and there was a lot of money that flowed in and out of his businesses, and apparently they had some problems with the cash flow on that one. The other thing that Jeremy Johnson was involved in, and I kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but it's important to note that he was also a partner in a company that processed online poker payments, and that ties back into the payments that were made to that Jeremy said were made to Senator Reid.
Right. Well,
to try to get his support for the online poker industry. So that's another aspect of this where a lot of the money comes through.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Robert Gerke.
All right. Thanks for your time.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Gerke, who's a politics and government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about what we're going to be talking about the Democrats' Obama problem. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Kuttner, who is the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. Robert Kuttner is the author of 9 books, including his latest, Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, The Democrats' Obama Problem. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Kuttner.
Ian, always a pleasure, and you're leaving out the best part, former station manager of Pacifica Radio New York.
Well, we may need you back. The network's in trouble. So, Robert, the president himself recently spoke out and, you know, in a kind of hand-wringing way, suggested that in terms of these upcoming midterms, the Democrats were being lazy. So do they see a Republican freight train barreling down the track towards them?
Well, the 6 year of a presidential incumbency is always bad for the president's party in Congress, because the voters are a little fed up. And if you go back through American history, the only exception in the past century to the pattern of the president's party losing seats in Congress is 98, Clinton's sixth year, also the year of Monica, because the Republicans overreached with the impeachment and there was a backlash against the Republicans. So the Democrats actually gained a few seats. So, number one, the deck is kind of stacked against the Democrats. Number two, it's a particularly bad year just by the luck of the draw for the Senate seats held by Democrats in swing states or conservative states. That's not totally luck of the draw, because a lot of those Democrats got in on Obama's coattails 6 years ago when he was elected president. But it's worse than usual in terms of 7 or 8 Democrats being vulnerable, and if 5 lose, it's a tie, and Vice President Biden breaks the tie. If 6 lose, the Republicans take control of the Senate. So there's that. Then there is the Obamacare fiasco, and the fact that Obama himself has seemed like kind of a feckless leader. He got into bed with the austerity people. And only in the past few months has he been making serious noises about we got to do something about wages. And most folks think that that's the result of the political team realizing that this is an issue that Americans care about, that some of the ballot initiatives to raise the minimum wage or to add paid vacation or paid sick leave, these are the sorts of things that will remind voters to come out and vote, to come out and vote for Democrats, remind voters why Democrats actually are different some of the time from Republicans. But it's a day late and a dollar short. So that was the point of the piece that I wrote in Huffington.
So, Robert Kuttner, in terms of what can the president do, which you've mentioned in the article, it would seem that what is obvious is the enormous difference between presidential turnout and midterm turnout. It's almost twice as much in a presidential turnout. In 2008, 140 million voted, and Obama and the Democrats swept all branches of government. And then 2 years later, only 75 million voted, and the Republicans won handily. And I imagine this time around in 2014, they have a better ground game. They've learned from what happened to them in Ohio, and they'll have unlimited money. So what is Obama going to do about turnout?
Well, just Obama, but he and the Democrats need to nationalize the election, meaning turn it into a referendum on which party cares more about regular people. And these wage issues, income issues, 1% issues, all of that stuff helps. Republicans are going to cut your Social Security. They're going to cut your Medicare. Republicans have a tax reform plan that's really more tax relief for the rich, and they're going to, you know, get rid of some of the preferences that actually help regular people, like the homeowner deduction. One of the ways to get turnout up in a midterm is to try and create real difference between the two parties and remind voters that that's there. And, you know, Newt Gingrich did this in the midterm of 1994, where Clinton, in his first 2 years, overreached on his health reform, and Gingrich came out with a contract with America and sold it as something that could help regular people. and really whacked Clinton. So occasionally you do find a case of a midterm election that demonstrates differences between the two parties, plays to the advantage of one party or another. The problem is that more often than not, it's the out party that uses that strategy against an incumbent president. It's hard to think of a time when an incumbent president used it against the out party, except in really unusual circumstances. One that comes to mind is the first midterm election when Roosevelt had been president for 2 years in 1934. But, of course, Roosevelt was phenomenally popular at that point, and Obama isn't. So if the president is a lead weight on the rest of the ticket, it's kind of hard.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Kuttner, who is a co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. Robert Kuttner is the author of nine books, including his latest, Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility, and he has an article at the Huffington Post, The Democrats' Obama Problem. Well, what Obama said recently, though, when he said that the Democrats are lazy, I mean, he was making it sound like the Democrats had a Democrat problem, that he had a problem with them. So what did he mean by that, and what has been the response from the Democrats in the House and Senate?
Well, I don't know that the Democrats are lazy. I think Obama hasn't been tough enough on all of these pocketbook issues, and it's not very good to get the president and members of his party into a dogfight with each other. I mean, there was also kind of a lot of sloppy political work. I mean, Obama, for the most part, has appointed relatively centrist people, so he decides in an election year when several Democrats are running in very conservative states trying to hold on to their seats to make a really terrific appointment of a very progressive assistant attorney general for civil rights, who then became a lightning rod for conservative Democrats, and seven Democrats voted against him, so he didn't get confirmed. Well, I'm always for appointing progressives, but you know, the time to appoint this guy would have been 2 years ago, and maybe be a little more prudent in an election year so that you don't shoot yourself in the foot. The same thing with the fellow that he appointed to be Surgeon General. This is a guy who's been very outspoken on the need for gun control as a public health measure, and predictably, Democrats in conservative states like Montana and West Virginia, where people love their guns, you know, voted against the guy. So it's a combination of sloppy political work and not being tough enough on the pocketbook issues. So it's a bit much for him to then turn around and blame other Democrats. The congressional wing of the Democratic Party, with a few exceptions, since the beginning of the Obama administration, has been more of a progressive party than the presidential wing. And that's because Obama got into bed with Wall Street in the appointments that he made on key economic positions. And then also, even though the Republicans keep eating his lunch, he continued to be Mr. Conciliator. He continued to be Mr. Budget Austerity. And it just doesn't work. People don't vote for those policies.
Well, I think they also, as you mentioned earlier, that he's got the impression or the reputation of being somewhat feckless and bending over to being too conciliatory. What about taking the gloves off? I mean, Harry Reid appears to be taking the gloves off because he knows that the Koch brothers are desperately, they'll pour any amount of money in order to get Mitch McConnell to be the next majority leader so that he'll do their bidding.
Right.
So why not take a cue from Harry Reid?
Well, because that's not who Obama is. I mean, Harry Reid is an alley cat. He's a fighter. He, you know, you don't get elected in a place like Nevada as a progressive Democrat unless you're a real fighter. And Harry Reid's been great. I mean, Harry Reid was the guy who finally pulled the plug on the Republican filibuster and helped Obama actually get people through. So It's partly ideological, Ian, and it's partly temperamental. He's a centrist Democrat. He's not a fighter. And what Democrats need, what ordinary working Americans need, is somebody who's a fighter for regular people. So I worry that, all of us are going to die for his sins, in the sense that if he is such a drag on the ticket that Democrats lose control of the Senate, then nothing happens for the next 2.5 years, and it's not really clear who that sets up to be in better shape for the 2016 elections. But it means that these problems, these economic problems that really hurt ordinary Americans, just continue to fester, and Republicans continue to use Obama as a pinata.
But surely he has a dog in this fight. He'll be an early lame duck. Doesn't he have every reason to want to keep a Democratic majority in the Senate?
Yeah, sure. And that's why you see these gestures like, let's have the Labor Department crack down on failure to pay overtime, and let's have a higher minimum wage. So it's like a watchdog who's been asleep, who sort of sleepily opens one eye. And it's better than nothing, but the average person who, sees billionaires making out like bandits, whose neighborhood property values are being dragged down by the continuing foreclosure crisis in poor neighborhoods, who hasn't gotten a raise, whose job is insecure, maybe who's working two or three jobs, the average person who maybe had a really bad experience trying to sign up for the Affordable Care Act, looks at these gestures and says to himself or herself, is that really going to make a difference in my life? Maybe I'm just better off voting for the Republicans because the Republicans are going to cut my taxes. And that's the bind that Obama has gotten himself into and that he puts Democrats into. And so if you have somebody running in a place like West Virginia or Montana or North Carolina, Arkansas, Louisiana, conservative states where a Democrat who really works hard for ordinary people can win a seat, and Obama is kind of an embarrassment, what do you do? Do you attack your president? Do you kind of swallow hard and support your president? You try and say, elect me and I'll pressure the White House to fix Obamacare? He puts his own party in a really tough position.
So what do you make, Robert Kuttner, of the Republicans suddenly going silent on the Affordable Care Act? It's been their obsession. They voted the Congress over 40 times, voted to repeal it. They've been beating the drum on this forever, and now they've gone silent. And I've heard strategists suggest that the Republicans are waiting for it to implode because they think that middle-class people are going to be affected by the rise in price, that so far it's helped the uninsured and the poor, and that there's going to be a huge backlash to it. I've been trying to look for evidence of that. I've had some anecdotal evidence from people who've said that their policies have gone up and they're not happy about it. But is there something to that, do you think, Robert?
I'm not sure they've gone totally silent. It's certainly in a lot of Republican advertising, a lot of TV spots against Democrats. They used it in the Florida race. Pundits made a great deal of the fact that when the Republican claimed victory, the Republican didn't mention Obamacare specifically, but I think that's a blip. And I do think that as premiums go up, some of which is not the result of Obamacare, premiums have been going up as employers have shifted costs to employees, deductibles and co-pays have gone up as employers have shifted payroll costs to employees, but it gets blamed on Obamacare. So I think they're going to continue to whack away at it. And unfortunately, this is an era when people are used to going on the Internet and buying something from Amazon or from whoever, and it's very easy And the smartest entrepreneurs in American capitalism spend a lot of effort figuring out how to make transactions on the Internet very easy, and then they come upon the, healthcare.gov website, and it's like it was invented by idiots, and it confirms the suspicions of a lot of people who don't like government anyway, that you couldn't organize, you couldn't trust the government to organize a two-car funeral. So this is another albatross. I don't think it was just the rollout, by the way. I think this was a Rube Goldberg contraption. I think the whole thing was much too complicated in conception and design, and so a bungled rollout was almost inevitable because it was so damn complicated. That's why single payer would work a lot better. So all these chickens are coming home to roost, and I'm sure the Republicans are going to hang this around the necks of Democrats in the fall campaign.
So then, you know, you have this anomaly in American politics where you have one party, the minority party, who are always able to get almost every last one of their people out to vote, and they're very good at suppressing the likely Democratic voters, and they're working overtime on that. And then you've got the other party that has a natural majority but fails to inspire its people to turn up. So just in closing, is there anything out there that you think, apart from something that may happen, either fortuitously to work for the Democrats or...
Yeah, I think Obama may be facing a near-death experience in terms of his final 2 years as a pathetic lame duck, could have a kind of conversion experience and start sounding like a real progressive. There's that famous line of Winston Churchill's that you can always count on Americans to do the right thing after they've tried everything else, and I think that's a good description of Obama. So, you know, let's see if he has a near-death experience and starts doing the right thing.
Well, Robert Cutner, I thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Cutner, who is co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. Robert Cutner is the author of 9 books, including his latest, Debt as Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility, and he has an article at the Huffington Post, The Democrats' Obama Problem. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.